Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by Leveson Wood, the British explorer, photographer, best-selling author and TV presenter. You probably know him from his incredible walking expeditions, which he's documented on TV. He's walked the length of the River Nile, through Central America from Mexico to Colombia, and the length of the Himalayas from Bhutan all the way to Afghanistan. We talk about the time he hitchhiked from Nottingham to India and his adventures along the way, what it was like driving an ambulance from London to Malawi in Southern Africa through 27 countries. And about his most recent and maybe most ambitious expedition yet, which was a 5,000-mile circumnavigation of the Arabian Peninsula from Iran to Lebanon. Ooh, we've got a lot of miles to cover. So let's hear from Leveson Wood. Leveson Wood, thank you so much for being here. When I was looking through your travel trajectory, I was thinking to myself, wow, his travel diaries are going to be astonishing. So I can't wait to kick off. The first chapter of your travel diaries is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
I think it was Greece when I was about 4 years old. And I just remember being on a beach in the sun, being fed cherries by my mother.
That sounds wonderful. Blissful.
It was blissful, and perhaps it was something. It was a very happy memory, and a very happy childhood. And I remember just enjoying the sunshine. And I think that was something that has stuck with me, is being in a foreign place, eating nice food, enjoying a bit of sunshine. And it's the simple things in life. And I think that travel doesn't have to be complicated. It can simply be a form of escapism. And we often, and I'm the sort of guiltiest person of doing this, is to try and sometimes overcomplicate travel and always find reasons to go to places. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with just going somewhere for a bit of sun.
Right. So not all of your trips are big expeditions. Sometimes you might just fancy an all-inclusive on the beach.
Well, maybe not an all-inclusive, but people do tend to pigeonhole me as that guy that walks everywhere, and mm-hmm. that's actually quite a recent thing for me. It's something I've been doing for the last decade. But no, I'd always travel. I always enjoyed travel, and ever since I was a kid, I was determined to see as much of the world as possible. Uh-huh. And I was just fascinated by other cultures, other geographies, other landscapes. And it was that sense of otherness that I think appealed. And growing up, you know, the suburbia of Stoke-on-Trent in the 1980s was probably good enough reason to travel as any. And perhaps that's where my own inspiration came from.
And was it that kind of initial wanderlust that led you into the army as your first port of call?
I think it was that also tempered with some realities of what I'd heard from my father, who was in the TA, so he was a part-time soldier in the 70s and 80s, and my grandfather, who fought in the Second World War in Burma.
Wow.
And, you know, sort of sitting there as a 10-year-old listening to his stories of fighting in the jungles of the Far East was actually, you know, quite remarkable, because he was a young man who at the age of 18 had barely left his hometown. You know, he was working in factories as a you know, making pots and bits of ceramics in the potteries. And for him to go off as an 18-year-old and be in India, in Calcutta, in Kohima, these were all very exotic names. And I was fascinated by the concept of going on a journey, on a quest almost. And my father, who was a teacher, he always encouraged me to read. And I remember reading stories, classics, actually. He made me read a lot of the Greek classics.
Wow.
And so I remember reading the Odyssey as a young man, probably not the original, but certainly the children's book version. And just being fascinated by the story of, you know, somebody who goes away on an adventure. And I always determined that I wanted to go away on my own adventures when I was old enough to do so.
From the army, what was your thinking about then moving into exploration? How did that change come about?
Well, the army gave me plenty of practical experience. You know, I joined the parachute regiment, where I served all around the world. I was on operations in Afghanistan in 2008, but I also went on exercises as far afield as Belize in Central America, Malawi in Southern Africa.
Wow, so it involved a lot of travel.
A lot of travel. And I really enjoyed that element. And, to be honest, I would have spent the entire 5 years that I spent in the regular army traveling if it was down to me. But It was mixed in with the more sort of more mundane, marching around and going on courses and lots of paperwork. So when I decided that I wanted to leave the army, I thought I wanted to sort of let my creative juices flow a little bit and wanted to take up writing and photography and test myself in a different way. But all underpinned by a desire to travel. So the first thing I did when I left the army was spend all my savings on buying a camera and bought a one-way ticket to Mexico to go and learn photography. Completely self-taught. And, of course, what happened on day three of arriving in Mexico was having my camera stolen.
Oh.
And it wasn't insured.
It was a
lesson in life. But really, it was off the back of that trip, actually, that this all came about, because I then volunteered for a charity in Africa, and the charity wanted some ambulances. So I gathered a few friends together, we raised some money, and I ended up driving an ambulance from London down to Malawi in Southern Africa. It was incredible. It was through 27 countries, 10,000 miles, with a bunch of mates, and it was just the most epic road trip one could imagine, through every kind of environment, all the way through Europe, through the Middle East, went through Syria, and then all through, across the Sahara Desert, and then all the way down through East Africa.
And that kind of kicked off what you've been continuing to do now.
Yeah, so that was 2010. Mm-hmm. I just remember, I'd never been so happy. It was great. I was with friends doing this amazing journey, and I thought, well, if I can find a way of turning this into a lifestyle that could sustain itself, then why not? And ever since I was a kid, I'd always wanted to, as I said before, travel and explore the world, but to do that and share the journeys with other people through writing, through photography, was my real passion. Funnily enough, volunteering for a charity doesn't pay very well. In fact, it didn't pay at all. So I had to find a way of monetizing it. So I ended up setting up an expedition company. So I started leading expeditions, paying clients to far-flung places using my experiences in the army. So my USP was taking people to former conflict zones. So we organized expeditions to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Sudan, all the sort of holiday hotspots, really. but funnily enough, it business was booming, and actually people wanted to see the reality of what life is like beyond the usual media.
And the beautiful places that I'm sure exist in every single one of those countries. Traveling through Arabia, we know it through the eyes of the media, through that war-torn lens. And I wondered which places that you touched upon on this trip where you felt like it's such a shame that more people can't see the beauty of this place.
Well, the media is very lazy, and we and so is the audience, I'm afraid. People do like to stereotype and pigeonhole certain countries as with a tourist and with a reputation, and it's very difficult to shake that off. And I see that as part of my job, and that's something I've really wanted to do over the last 10 years is not going to places with a sort of bucket list mentality, or going to places that, I don't like the idea of dark tourism either, but I think it is important to go to places, if they are genuinely safe, or if there's a way of accessing them, show that. Because, you hear places like Colombia, you can go on holiday to Colombia, it's absolutely fine. But people think, oh no, there's still rebels in the jungle, it's narco traffickers and all that.
Well, that's done quite well, and I think in kind of improving its reputation as
Colombia's,
well.
Colombia's, getting there, but it's just taken a long time, hasn't it? Chechnya, not so much. Chechnya is perfectly safe. You can go to Chechnya if you can get a visa to get in, that is. But it's not, Grozny is not some rubbled city, that it was 15 years ago. It's there's big skyscrapers there. There's an entirely new city that's been rebuilt. And the same goes for lots of places that I think it's very important to show people what the reality is and challenge people's stereotypes, challenge their preconceptions. And that's what I've tried to do with the latest journey through the Middle East, is go to a region that's perhaps the most contested, the most controversial, and probably got the worst reputation out of the lot. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the Middle East, what do you think of? You think of terrorism, you think of bombs going off, conflict, and even the most banal attitudes are usually little more than deserts and camels.
And of those places that you visited, which country or city or place even would you say sticks out in your mind as being the most spectacular?
I can't choose one because they're all very different, and that's something else that I like to draw out of my travels, is the diversity that you don't expect.
Of course, it's a whole region.
You can go to southern Yemen after the Karif in the rains, and it's lush jungle. It's forests of frankincense. It's beautiful. Same in Oman, in southern Dhofar mountains. It's not what you'd expect. In Lebanon, the snow-capped mountains, you can go skiing there. There's resorts. Not what most people think of. Damascus, the city in Syria, which has received so much attention over the last 7 years, all of it negative. But the reality is there are coffee shops, there are bars. I went clubbing in Damascus.
Really?
And it's absolutely fine.
So life is continuing.
Life continues. Yeah. It really does. And what's interesting is you go there and you meet people. You're having a coffee and drinking a glass of wine in the old city of Damascus. Mm. And, you can hear the bombs going off 3 or 4 miles away in the suburbs where the fighting's happening. They don't bat an eyelid. They carry on with their lives. And they, there's this sense of, enduring robustness. And can you imagine that happening here? It's like sitting here as the artillery's firing off in Chelsea. But people just get on with their lives. And we often overlook
that. I had no idea, actually. Yeah. That's extraordinary. Chapter 2, that's the first place that you fell in love with. What would that be?
Probably South Africa. It was the first place that I went travelling as, backpacking as an 18-year-old on my very cliché gap year. And it was great. I went on my own. Before university, I went one-way ticket, or one of those round-the-world tickets. And I spent about 5 weeks travelling around South Africa. And it was the most terrifying, intimidating first few couple of weeks was just like, what am I doing? I'm 18 and all the other travellers are 25. And, it's so far.
Had you been that far from home before?
Well, not really. Certainly not. That was my first time I'd been travelling on my own. It wasn't the country that was scary. It wasn't the political situation. It was, what do you do in a hostel when you're on your own? How do you initiate a conversation? And it was quite an intimidating thing. But when I got into the sort of culture of backpacking, it was brilliant because I then, you can kind of replicate the experience in every hostel you stay in, and you force yourself to talk to people and you grow as a person. And I think when you take those sorts of risks, and people are very scared about, of risk, when you do that and you put yourself out there and you travel on your own, because I think there's something very important. It should be mandatory. Everyone should travel on their own. Don't go with friends. Go on your own, because you learn so much about other people. You learn so much about other cultures. You learn so much about yourself that you just become a better, more well-rounded person. And I think it's really, for me, was the formative part of what where my travels began as an adult. So for me, it was South Africa where I learned that.
Which part of South Africa?
Well, I flew into Cape Town.
Into Cape Town, yeah.
And then I basically backpacked and hitchhiked my way all the way up the Garden Route, and then up to Johannesburg, and then from there went up to Zimbabwe.
And you were hitchhiking?
Yeah, I was just hitchhiking, and it was great. And, I barely paid for any accommodation or lifts, because people look at you, what are you doing? You're only 18. I said, I know. And they just invite you into their homes. They feed you, they feel sorry for you, probably wouldn't get the same sense of sympathy as, at my age now, but certainly at that age, in that period, very fresh face, people, I sort of came away from every place that I stayed with a bag full of food, because people would feel a bit sorry for me.
So, lovely hospitality there. Chapter 3 is the trip where you learned the most about yourself.
So I'll talk about gap year 2 now.
Okay.
That was gap year 1. So I went to university, studied history, and my speciality was, funnily enough, overland journeys. I actually studied the Grand Tour and the Great Pilgrimages and the Silk Road. So that was my particular interest. I'm one of the few people that's probably studied history and actually got to use it in later life.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when I graduated, I thought, before I joined the army, because I'd always wanted to join the army, I thought I'm going to take another few months off, which ended up being another 12 months, to go and basically do my own great overland journey. So I thought, why not, following in the footsteps of the people that had inspired me. And do the big overland journey to India. So I decided in the summer of 2004 to hitchhike from Nottingham, where I studied, to India. And that's what I did. And at the age of 22, put my thumb up on the services at on the A1 at Grantham, and went down to Calais. And
no way.
Yeah, and carried on from there.
That's amazing. I mean, I tend not to see that many hitchhikers these days. I mean, did you see other people hitchhiking?
There were. I mean, it's actually still very popular in Europe, particularly in, not so much in France. Actually, the only times I didn't get picked up were in France and Russia.
Right.
But everywhere else was brilliant.
And did you have any kind of hairy experiences?
Nothing hitchhiking related. No,
right.
Everyone went out of their way. I mean, people would say, where are you going? And I'd sort of jokingly say India, and they said, don't be ridiculous, and so you had to kind of temper it. So I'd say, okay, I'm going to the next city, and
yeah,
but that for them, because it was more, you could, it's a very difficult concept to grasp that someone's hitchhiking for 5 months to India.
Yeah.
So if you say you're hitchhiking to Munich or to Prague, they're like, wow, that's like hundreds of miles away. And they would divert and take you an hour out of their way to make sure that you got dropped off at the best junction.
Wow.
It was fantastic. But on that journey, you know, I went through, you know, again, all the way through Europe, through Russia, over the Caucasus Mountains, through Iran, through Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Amazing.
And that was probably the journey that I learned the most, because at that age, again, at 22, I was putting myself into places that, you know, you probably wouldn't want necessarily think are very safe. But
or maybe your parents.
Certainly
might
my
feel
parents
like that, yeah.
Didn't think I was. But actually, again, you know, in the places that one would think are dangerous, actually, I probably got the best hospitality. Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan during Ramadan. And I was so incredibly well looked after, in spite of the, you know, the fact that it had only recently been, you know, the Taliban had only recently been defeated. It was a fascinating trip.
Wow. You talk about the risk, you know, weighing up of risk on these trips, or that people focus too much on risk. When you take a journey like that, and the future journeys and expeditions that you've been on, how do you weigh up what is going to be, you know, just fulfilling, and what is going to be life threatening?
Well, I take risk very seriously. You know, it's been my job for certainly since I was in the army. When it comes to risk, it's all about proportionality. And I think when you go on a trip, you know, you've got to assess what's the most commonplace dangers. And when I say this to people, people think, well, you know, you might get shot by the Taliban or ISIS, or you might get eaten by a crocodile, or all these things, which could happen. Of course they could.
Yeah.
But they're very rare. You know, you've got to be very, very unlucky to get eaten by a crocodile.
Yeah.
What you don't have, you know, what is far more commonplace, but also a bit more mundane and boring, is being involved in a road traffic accident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being hit by a bus. You know, that can happen in London as much as it can in Karachi or in Delhi,
yeah,
or anywhere else for that matter. So, but that's the biggest danger, is being in a road traffic accident, being hit by a drunk driver, or getting some really boring disease like malaria. You know, that's far more likely, or getting ill from drinking the water. So when it comes to risk, it's those things that you should really worry about, not the sort of getting kidnapped and all the rest of it, because that is probably not going to happen. It's very unlikely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination. What would that be?
I don't have one. I genuinely don't, because I think my own travel experiences, and I think most people would probably agree, are generally defined by who you're with and the people that you're either traveling with, or if you're traveling alone, then the people that you encounter along the way. And it's those experiences that for me define a place,
the human
element. And it's not, you know, if you ask me where's the most beautiful mountain, I can tell you where's the most sublime desert scenario, I could tell you, but I don't have a favorite place, because for me the sense of place is really dictated by the experiences within that place. And I don't like to use our own constructed borders to define places. And I don't think most of the local people do either. Mm-hmm. So for me, I don't have a favourite place. I have favourite experiences and encounters.
Okay. So tell me.
Yeah,
go on then.
Well, I've had so many, it's difficult to pick and choose.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I could go with the cliched meeting the Dalai Lama in India.
I was going to ask you about that. Do tell me what it was like.
It was something that...
Are you a spiritual man, would you say?
Spiritual, probably, yes, I think, yes. I wouldn't say religious, but, you know, I do look for mysticism and spirituality in places where I go. And for me, meeting, this spiritual leader who is effectively for a significant portion of humanity, the living incarnation of an entire belief system...
Yeah.
Was quite something.
I can't imagine.
Down to earth, very moving. He had a real aura of energy. I mean, the guy's 80-odd and just, he didn't stop laughing and chuckling. He's got this real sense of warmth and humour.
Was this pre or post Glastonbury appearance?
This was when he just got back from Glastonbury, so maybe he's still
riding high off of that.
Exactly. But no, just very welcoming and a very funny man. And but really for me, it's just the meeting amazing people. I was in Georgia when I hitchhiked to India. I went via Georgia and I was basically just sleeping rough wherever I could. And one afternoon or early evening, I sort of got out of a lift and I'd been on a ride in the car, and in the middle of nowhere, the next village was a couple of miles away. So I thought, I'm just going to sleep on the side of the road and under a bus shelter.
Yeah.
And anyway, I did that. And about midnight, it was dark. I sort of woke up to the sound of voices. This man who'd obviously been drinking, I could hear him coming out of the darkness towards me. I thought, oh dear, this is not going to end well. Anyway, he started shouting at me in Georgian. I didn't speak much Georgian, so we didn't really communicate. He then started shouting at me in Russian. I couldn't really communicate with that either. And eventually we settled on my very basic GCSE level German. And he instructed me to follow him, so I did. I went back to his house, and he basically told me that I was staying there. I said, well, that's very kind of you. But before he sort of, you know, gave me a bedroom, he insisted on we shared a bottle of homemade moonshine vodka.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, the following morning I wanted to thank him to leave, but he wasn't anywhere to be found. So I tried to basically just leave via the front door, but he had this enormous dog in the garden, which was barking at me and pretty savagely, so I couldn't leave. So anyway, I went back to bed to nurse off my hangover, and a few hours later he came back, and just as I was explaining that I needed to leave, he turned up with another bottle of vodka and insisted that I drank that with him. So basically I was stuck in his house for 3 days, and on the final day I said I'd had enough of this. I basically had to escape because I couldn't go through the garden, so I climbed down the drain pipe across the neighbor's roof and then onto the garden.
So you didn't have to drink anymore.
So I didn't have to drink anymore. But that was 2004, and I'd always remembered that name, because his name ironically was Gotcha. And so in 2017, so 13 years later, I went back to make a documentary about the Caucasus Mountains, and it was on, you know, on the TV. It was called Russia to Iran.
Yeah.
And I hitchhiked, you know, through the part of the same route that I'd done when I hitchhiked to India the first time around. And I got to Georgia, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could find that same village where I'd slept in the bus stop? And I did. I found the bus stop was still there 13 years on. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could find Gotcha? So I was looking around and found some old ladies and said, is there a guy called Gotcha living here? And they said, yeah, it's just up there on the left. And it all came flooding back to me. I said, yeah, this is the house. So I went and knocked on the door, and door opened, and there he was, Gotcha, 13 years later.
No way.
He looked me up and down and said, ah, Englishman. He disappeared into his kitchen, came back with another bottle of vodka and said, right, time to drink. And it's moments like that that really define the magic of travel for me.
Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, a place that people might not know about that you particularly would recommend or love.
I think Lebanon, actually. It was a really, really... I was only there very briefly on the tail end of my most recent journey around the Arabian Peninsula. And I chose that because it's, you know, well, it's on the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. It's the kind of gateway to the Middle East. And so to finish there on the shores, basically on the boundaries of Europe, kind of brought everything full circle, and it felt like a bit of a homecoming. It was really, really beautiful. It was, you know, the mountains, the food, and very, very developed, actually. You get to sort of cities like Byblos, one of the ancient cities in the world, but you know, there's great cafe culture. And I'd love to go back, actually, and see more of it. And it's still got a bit of a reputation, you know, because of the political situation there, that people do tend to avoid it. But certainly from my experiences, from the limited time that I was there, you could absolutely go there for a long weekend and have a great time.
Yeah. There are some new hotels that are opening up there as well. Mm. So I guess it shows, hopefully, that tourism is beginning again.
Yeah.
I think it was. Was it?
It was, you know, back in the sort of 60s and 70s. It was the sort of the Paris of the East, wasn't
it?
And sadly, that all fell apart.
And what's the architecture like there?
Well, obviously, it did get, you know, Beirut did get fairly destroyed in the war. But you know, if you go out into places like, you know, the Bekaa Valley, and there's the ancient Roman ruins in Baalbek, for instance, are just magnificent.
So steeped in history.
Absolutely.
And where have you eaten best, would you say? Because I imagine you've tasted food. All kinds of
good and cuisines. Bad.
Yeah, yeah. And the worst too, actually.
Well, I'm a huge fan of curries, so I just love India, really, for its food and just the variety. That's for me, that's my favourite. But Southeast Asia as well. I was recently out in Bali, and, you know, I just love that Southeast Asian food, Thai, Vietnamese. Yeah, I'm a big foodie, so anything like that.
And have you had to eat some pretty hairy things as well?
I got fed, I think it was in Uganda, I got fed a bush rat, which is just the most awful stew. It was like these rats, which are about a foot long.
A foot long?
Yeah, massive. It's still covered. They literally just get them, singe them over the fire. So you've still got these stubbly, charred bodies that they then basically just chuck into a pot. And,
oh my God.
It's vile, yeah.
Oh my goodness! Have you had to eat any insects?
Insects are fine. Yeah, I've had you know, crickets, grasshoppers, and all that sort of stuff. They're fine.
They're not too bad.
No, that's fine. I'm not a fan of brains. I was forced to have goat's brains and eyeballs in the Middle East quite a lot.
Chapter 6 is the place that you would never go back to.
Oh, I'm going to get banned by some tourism boards, aren't I now? I am actually, sadly, I think, banned from a couple of countries.
No way.
Very
why?
Sad. Well, the Russia to Iran program that I made and the book that I wrote was, I thought, very complimentary about Iran, because I had a wonderful time there. I've been there twice before.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the people were remarkably hospitable, some of the most hospitable in the world, and it's a beautiful country, and I'd highly recommend, if you can get a visa and they'll let you in, to try and travel to Iran, because it's a beautiful place. Sadly, I don't think the Iranian government saw that side of my film and took you know, took umbrance at the fact that I highlighted, you know, the very obvious political dissent in the country and the fact that not everyone's happy with the regime there, and said that I might not be welcome back, sadly.
That's such a shame. That's interesting, because on the one hand, you want to advocate tourism in a beautiful country, but then at the same time, if you can't even speak openly about what's going on in an obvious way.
Well, you know, my journeys and the products, you know, the books and the documentaries, I've always been, you know, tried to be as honest as I can and tell it how it is. And more often than not, it's going to countries that everyone thinks are bad in the vaguest possible way, and showing them actually there's a lot of good there. Mm-hmm. And going to countries like Sudan, which has got a bit of a reputation, saying, there's an amazing people there. I mean, what's happened in recently, the developments there demonstrate that the people don't want the dictatorship and are actually trying to overthrow it. So hopefully something will come of that. Mm. But, you know, if I get to a place where the government doesn't treat me very well, or I get, you know, I have a bad experience, I'll say that as well. And but you know, 9 times out of 10, it's generally finding positives in what people perceive to be dangerous or difficult places.
On the flip side, if you could parachute yourself immediately anywhere in the world right now, where would it be, do you think?
Right now? Ooh. To be honest, there's fewer nicer places than the Mediterranean in the summer, so I'd probably go to a beach in Greece, which is exactly what I'm doing next week, actually.
Are you?
Going to Corfu, which will be lovely, on just a normal holiday. So, I'm kind of just doing what I, going to the places that are still on my list of places to visit. I've still yet to go to New Zealand. I really want to go there. I really want to go to Western Canada. I've not been to Vancouver Island, but Jahaira is beautiful. The world's a big place. There's you know, dozens of countries that I'd still love to go to.
As a former army man, are your holidays quite regimented?
No, I don't do any planning. I generally turn up, usually without any accommodation, book something on a website 10 minutes before, see what's available. And that's what I love, because when I do an expedition, often there's a lot of planning that goes into it. So when I go on holiday, it's nice to just go and relax and leave it to the last minute. And sometimes I'll get there and say, okay, I'm going to book a villa for a couple of nights, sometimes whatever, you know, just see what's available.
Mm-hmm. Finally, then, we're on to chapter 8, and that is what's at the top of your wish list.
New Zealand, Canada, Papua New Guinea. I really want to go to Papua New Guinea. I've not really seen much of South America as well. I'd love to do a big motorbiking journey through South America. Yeah, I've become a bit of a biker recently, so I want to do a big trip. And I think, South America, Brazil, Argentina, Chile and Patagonia would be great.
The documentary after this one, then.
Possibly.
Potentially. Let's see. Space. Leveson, with those were your travel diaries. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. That was Leveson Wood. Wow, his life really is one incredible adventure. If you'd like to hear more about his recent expedition, you can pick up a copy of his book, Arabia, A Journey Through the Heart of the Middle East. And he's also written a gorgeous children's book called Incredible Journeys, and that's out now too. As ever, if you've enjoyed this episode, your support with a review or a rating is so appreciated, and it helps other people discover the podcast. And come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like, Last autumn, when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.